From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Eric, Mark, welcome back. Pleasure to have you.
Hey, Don.
Don,
hey,
Mark. Always glad to be on CPR.
Hey, thanks.
Love it.
We love having you. So I believe, Eric, it's your turn to begin. We're going to talk first about the U.S., I guess you could call it laughingly, politics, the whole circus that's going on in and around Iowa, New Hampshire, and on TV here in the United States.
Yeah, it's not something I usually spend a lot of time talking about because, I mean, call me cynical if you must, but I don't really buy into any of the so-called elections in the United States generally. I mean, I understand that especially at the local level, maybe even, you know, the county and state level, sometimes elections can really be of significance. But at the national level, U.S. politics is more or less an appendage of a very small oligarchy that really dominates the United States and dominates the political culture and the political system. So with that in mind, every candidate is in some capacity an element of that. So for that reason, I'm sort of a bit, cautious about getting too worked up about any of this. But it is true that there have been some interesting developments in the last few weeks, in the last few months. I mean, obviously, people in the U.S. and people around the world are familiar with the with the growth of what I would somewhat derisively call Trumpism, which is not a thing, but let's just say it is. And, the rise of Trump and what Trump means. And, you know, Mark, I think it was last week, although it might have been 2 weeks ago, was mentioning how he would love to see a Trump presidency just because of the comic value of it and also the havoc that it would wreak on U.S. European relations. So I understand that, obviously, and there's a part of me somewhere that agrees with that. But of course, living in the United States and having to deal with Americans on a daily basis, I am very concerned about not Trump. I'm not concerned at all about Trump. I'm concerned about the kind of base that he is mobilizing and energizing. I saw a recent report, a study that was conducted of Trump's Twitter following, and I believe it was 50, or I'm sorry, not Trump's Twitter following, but Trump's relation to Twitter users in the white supremacist neo-Nazi circles on Twitter in the United States. And I think it said 60% of the leaders, so-called leaders, yeah, or most outspoken white supremacist neo-Nazis and just, you know, Klansmen and others online in the United States, I think 60% of them follow Trump, and some insane large number of retweets from Trump coming out of that camp. And just, I mean, I understand that Twitter is not, you know, the best barometer of everything necessarily, but right, just as a snapshot, that's the kind of danger that I think we need to be very cautious about when talking about someone like Trump or Ted Cruz or, you know, anybody else. And I'm not particularly frightened of Trump. I'm somewhat concerned about who might follow Trump and who might take over that base in the next, say, 8 to 10 to 12 to 15 years. So that's what I'll say about Trump. And I think Mark and I agree, although I don't want to put words in his mouth, I don't take Trump seriously. I really don't. I don't think his candidacy is a real thing. I mean, even if he wins the Republican nomination, I still don't take it particularly seriously. All of the indications from the studies that I have seen show that Hillary or Bernie absolutely trounce Trump in a general election. And I read a report from a conservative publication yesterday, which said that they, according to their analysis, something like 40% of the Republican Party would side with Hillary Clinton against Trump. And that includes the vast majority of what I guess you could call the neocon establishment in Washington, for whom Hillary Clinton is a far better representative of their politics and their aims than even Trump is, I think, for a number of reasons. So,
but we also see polls coming out of the Hill that show 20% of Democrats would defect to vote for Trump over Hillary Clinton.
I mean, right. You know, however much stock we put in these polls, you know, it's possible. I could buy that. I don't want to speak too forcefully on it because I haven't really gone in depth on the polling data and all of that stuff. But from what I saw, based on certain projections in an electoral college count, Hillary Clinton has like 460 compared to like, I don't know, 100 and whatever for Trump. Whether you buy that or not, I don't, you know, whatever. That's neither here nor there. Now, the other issue that I want to just bring up, and I know that I want to hear your guys' take on it as well, is Bernie Sanders, because, of course, Bernie Sanders is surging and the media is obviously seized on not only Bernie surging, but Hillary Clinton supposedly going down in flames over this email scandal, including the most recent report what was it, 20 or more of the emails that were on her 22 emails that were considered top secret or that were considered state secrets or, you know, confidential or whatever their
Here's what it is. Let me just give the fact of this thing.
Yeah,
here.
Thank you.
All right, you've got 22 of them. Essentially, there was a document demand made for all of these emails, and although
a court demand, the U.S. government
has admitted
they have failed to fulfill.
Right, and so and their defense, and they insist that they will not fulfill it because they say these are top secret. Now,
right,
they simply haven't met. That's just those 22 secret ones. They haven't met the volume that they're required to. They've only released 2,000 out of some 7,000.
Well, right.
Okay, and the reason they presented for doing so was the snowpocalypse in D.C.
Right, the snowpocalypse.
Right. Not the onion.
Right, which, that's right. What's cute, though. Yeah,
which inconvenienced me for a couple of
here's
hours.
Here's the cute thing here. And they're trying to walk both sides of the road. On the one hand, if they were top secret documents, then it's a per se violation of the law for her to have them in this open server that she was using.
If you or I had those, we would be in jail.
That's right. And on the other hand, they're not producing it because the only defense they have is to classify them as top secret. So the contents of those things are being hidden with this classification. She's basically looking at this two-edged sword and trying to claim politically they weren't top secret at the time, but now they're top secret.
I think both of you know more of the nitty gritty details of that. So I just want to make one final point here about Sanders, because I also don't think that Sanders is necessarily for real either. But, you know, I'm not necessarily in the majority there. But I just want to make the point that I think that ultimately, from my perspective, and I'll ask a question for you guys as well. Am I wrong in thinking that the question of releasing these emails and potentially deciding whether to indict Hillary Clinton has been deliberately postponed by the Obama administration till after New Hampshire?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, so I think that is a good indication of what we're talking about, what I'm referring to when I say this is controlled. I mean, this is theater.
Well,
under the control of people whose idea of who's going to be president, they will make it happen. They will manufacture that.
Mark, from looking at U.S. geopolitics in general, and particularly the neoliberal economic order, Bernie Sanders does represent, forgetting his his old military doctrine and, you know, all the foreign policy stuff. Changing from the politics of austerity in the United States would be a change from that entire kind of economic structure, like the economics of austerity and all of that. Is it possible that his election could create some sort of a change in the global economic order, at least the approach that's taken by the global economic order, maybe to a more Keynesian one or something?
Okay, well, first of all, let's just make clear that we're only talking theoretically here.
Of course.
Because we can't really consider elections in the United States in any way, shape, or form democratic. Bernie Sanders will never be the nominee of the Democratic Party. You know, I mean, he may – he certainly has the support of 30-35% of the Democratic Party base at this point, right? A lot of youth activists, a lot of energy, a lot of media buzz. The liberal media loves him right now. But it's not going to happen because the Democratic Party elites, the Mandarins, the, you know, the powers that be, the money lenders, you know, the big finance that Hillary and the Democratic Party are financed by, will never ever support a Bernie Sanders. But let's speak theoretically, and let's say something. The earth moved and Bernie Sanders was elected president. I think what we would see foremost on a foreign front is that we would see that the U.S. would become suddenly very insular, that they would become very inward-looking. And this is because a Bernie Sanders presidency would be locked in internecine struggles, you know, with U.S., you know, corporate rule, big finance rule of, you know, the U.S. economy. And he would make that his personal crusade. I think he would take a much less active role in U.S. interventionism in the world than other candidates, certainly more than Hillary Clinton, whom Robert Kagan, you know, the top U.S. neocon, has outright said she's a neocon. You know, her supporters don't call her a neocon.
Exactly.
But she's a neocon, and I would be very happy with her presidency.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
I mean,
that's
Bernie
exactly
Sanders,
what I was talking about.
Bernie Sanders is not a anti-imperialist or anything by any stretch of the imagination, you know. But what he has to say to be elected in U.S. politics and what a U.S. Bernie Sanders presidency would actually be, we don't know. But I think it would be more inward looking and a less interventionist, certainly, than the alternative. But like I said, that's not going to happen. Yeah. Right now, U.S. politics, let's not take it too seriously.
Exactly.
It's a theater. Let's enjoy the theater for what it's worth, because the spectacle of the Republican Party debates or non-debates with Trump not showing up and still winning the debates.
Yeah, right.
Still, certainly the ratings war and the media war over all of this, it was absolutely hilarious. It was amusing. I don't take a Trump candidacy seriously, but then I don't take American politics seriously.
Yeah,
and, you know, I offer my full-throated endorsement of Trump because of what, first of all, it's so apropos. I think the American people deserve Trump, and I think Trump deserves the American people. I don't believe anything Trump says. I believe the man is a lot more intelligent than he lets on. I think he's having a big laugh. I think every time something comes out, he and maybe a few handful of people, which probably includes the Clintons, are sitting back and saying, I can't believe they're still supporting me.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm still getting support.
Yeah.
Let's see what more outrageous thing I can say.
So
hang
I saw
on. Something.
Before
you go there, something I want to do, because, you know, this is fun, this part of it. But there's some serious thing behind it is this. Is there some part of the American elite or the American European elite that sees the writing on the wall for the existing neoliberal economic model that is looking to try to re-stimulate or, you know, rejuice their economy to buy it some, you know, extended life, that sees Sanders and, like, the whole, I guess, neo-Keynesian approach that he's talking about as something that they want to try to institute to blow some air into the economy? Is that possible?
No, because the Europeans are more neoliberal than the Americans are at this point.
I want to – so a mutual friend of ours made exactly that argument, and I think he was being, I would say, 50% serious and 50% facetious or whatever.
Yeah,
but he did say that, and, you know, socialists and, you know, far leftists will point to Franklin Roosevelt and I think somewhat unfairly, but regardless, will point to Franklin Roosevelt and say that the elite selected Roosevelt in order to save U.S. capitalism, in order to save it from the Depression and to, you know, to breathe new life into it and so forth. And
I don't buy
that argument. I don't either. I don't buy that argument exactly, but there are people who do make it, and I think that there are people who are making that same argument about Bernie Sanders, and I guess that is to some degree what Dawn is talking about, the notion that Sanders would be a way for the elites to somehow prop up an economic system, an economic order that is shown not only cracks, but that is in many ways completely collapsing, as we see with a number of issues. I'm articulating that point to illustrate that I don't agree with that.
No, that's giving them far too much credit.
Because, I agree.
You know, for recognizing the problems with the current system, because they have an ideological inability to recognize the problems that are staring them in the face.
The system is structurally created such that the destruction and all of these things that we could point to actually benefit it. I mean, it is set up in a way, whether disaster capitalism or what have you, all of these things are, in my view, making imperialism and the global capitalist system, all of these things, stronger, though more unpredictable.
Agreed. I global neoliberal capitalism isn't going anywhere.
No, it's not.
Okay. All right. So let's start talking about the real stuff in the world. Let's start with Syria.
Mark?
Okay. You want me to?
Yeah, Mark. Mark's talking. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. So, of course, the big news this week is the conference, non-conference, that is happening, not happening, in Geneva, that is peace talks, not peace talks. It has been rebranded Intra-Syria Dialogue, even though the Syrians actually aren't talking to each other. First of all, they're not even there yet, because the opposition, only in the last few hours have they finally change their position. And when I'm speaking the opposition, I mean the Riyadh-backed jihadists.
Right. I was going to say Riyadh, not Geneva, too.
The gaggle of jihadists with the FSA thrown in that was assembled in Riyadh and has sent people to Geneva under the title of the High Negotiation Committee, with one of the leaders, the chief spokesman, being from Jaish al-Islam, an outright terrorist organization, as Russia has spoken. But before we get to this farce, non-peace talks that people are not going to and they're not participating in, but they might listen, there was another event in Syria this week that I think is actually much more important if you look beneath the hood, that has been kind of left under the media notice. There's a report in Reuters this week. Syria rebels splits deepen after failed merger with Al-Qaeda arm. Okay, first of all, what you have to notice there right away with the Reuters headline is that they are basically acknowledging that at least half of the rebels are Al-Qaeda, and they don't have a problem with that.
That's right.
All right, they're not even going with the pretense anymore. The other arm that they're talking about is Ahrar al-Sham, which is an Al-Qaeda offshoot that doesn't get along with Al-Qaeda anymore. They attempted to merge these together this week, and this is something I've been talking about for a while. Yep. There has been an attempt over the last year and a half, out of the U.S. neocon circuits, particularly Brookings, and I'm looking at Charles Lister, they're funded by Qatar, to rebrand the Ahrar al-Sham, this horrible, awful Salafist jihadist, head-chopping gaggle of people that want to impose the strictest Sharia across Syria and would outright execute or ethnically cleanse all the Christians, Alawites, Shia, and everything else, to rebrand them as moderates, right? As something that has to be part of the political transition. And in a way, I mean, this actually makes some sense, because after ISIS, they are the largest territorial holder in Syria. And the third one is literally al-Qaeda itself, Jabhat al-Nusra. So, I mean, this is what the opposition, this is what the rebels really are.
Well,
now, there's been a, let me just finish there.
Yeah.
Al-Nusra is officially recognized as al-Qaeda and a terrorist organization by both the United States, which they're regretting now, right, and the United Nations. And there's a Security Council resolution calling for the eradication of them, along with ISIS, and anyone who associates with them.
That's right.
Which, of course, includes not only Ahrar al-Sham, but the so-called almost vanishing Free Syrian Army, which, you know, is fights with them, operates under their military command in the Joint Operations Room, and has become little bit more than the designated toeholders of al-Qaeda. So there's an attempt to merge al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, back into its offshoot, Ahrar al-Sham, so that we can pretend that al-Qaeda has just vanished. We can whitewash them and say that Ahrar al-Sham are moderates and bring them into the political transition. This is, in effect, turning over the Syrian government to al-Qaeda.
Right.
I mean, of course, the U.S. imagines that at the end of all these negotiations, their hand-picked group of liberal proxies that have been living in Istanbul or Arlington, you know, will be at the top. But this is what they seriously intend to do, because if they don't, then they have to allow what is the vast majority of the rebel force to be slaughtered after any theoretical political transition. They might even have to take a hand in it, and that would be extremely hashtag awkward.
Thank you for the hashtag. That helped. That helped accentuate the point. I agree pretty much with everything Mark said. The only caveat I wanted to add there, and forgive me for trying to intrude on your point there, I just wanted to add that one of the things that I find particularly interesting about this rebranding effort is that it's not even simply for the purposes of public relations.
No, not at all.
It is because of the reality on the battlefield over the last few years,
exactly.
Specifically in regards to how many of the smaller factions, regional, even, you know, town specific, city specific, how many of those have folded into these larger organizations. So when we look at Ahrar al-Sham, it's not simply that Ahrar al-Sham, you know, it burst onto the scene in its fully formed, structure that we see today. Ahrar al-Sham has grown significantly over the last couple of years by swallowing up a bunch of smaller groups, by, purchasing weapons from, you know, various FSA, so-called FSA factions, by, you know, welcoming them, by paying them, all of these things. So all of these groups have gotten folded into
because of the unlimited stream of money coming to them from Saudi.
Of course, yeah. Well, the stream of money coming from Saudi Arabia, specific to Ahrar al-Sham, and then also, of course, the U.S. Weapons that have been sent over the border in Turkey. I mean, I always point it out, but I think it's important. June 2012, New York Times headline, CIA said to steer arms to Syria rebels in Turkey. Now, all of this tells you that the weapons, the money, all of these things, it's like trickle up, you know, it's trickle up destabilization, trickle up proxy war, because they knew from the very beginning where that money and where those weapons were going to go, but they needed a way to be able to justify arming and financing the straight up al-Qaeda and ISIS elements that we're now talking about. And one of the ways that they've done that is through this folding in of smaller factions into groups like Ahrar al-Sham. And that's what allows Saudi Arabia to have this kind of a convocation in Riyadh in December and to be able to organize this in this sort of structure. So I think that point is important. The other thing I want to say in regards to Geneva 3, it's actually quite interesting.
Oh, no, we can't use Geneva 3 because that's bad. That would indicate the failure of Geneva 1 and 2. And
right.
Said, not allowed to refer to it as Geneva 3. It is the intra-Syrian dialogue that the Syrians have to be talking to each other. But
Geneva 3. about, can we do that? I don't know. Anyway, the question, the question that I have is, what's his name? Stéphane de Mistura has sort of created a structure that is significantly different from the previous two dialogues. And this structure is supposed to be, I guess, what he calls parallel track dialogues or something like that, where the two main factions, meaning the Syrian government and, you know, the, I don't know, whatever, the rebel opposition, whatever, you know.
Salafi style.
Yeah, yeah. That these two factions are not going to be in the same room. They're not going to be sitting across the table from each other. They're going to be speaking through intermediaries, structure based around working groups and these various other ways that he's doing.
De Mistura called it what? He had a term of art for that, the way they're doing it.
I don't know. I remember something about parallel track dialogue or something.
Yeah, something like serial consultation or parallel consultation.
Well, whoever, whatever.
It's like the little the kid in high school that's your friend that runs in between you and your would-be girlfriend to exchange messages, but you can't, you know, you can't ask her things directly yourself or something.
Or the kid who goes from one social circle to the next and thinks that he's friends with everybody, but everybody laughs at him.
Right when they leave.
Let's be clear. The Syrian government has said they're coming not to negotiate, but they'll listen. The opposition, which had refused to come, and Ahrar al-Sham is not there. They refused to come. Al-Nusra and ISIS were never invited. But what's left of the opposition, assembled by Riyadh, they say finally that they're coming, only in the last few hours. But they're not there to negotiate either. They'll participate.
Everybody's saying that. All the sides are saying that, and nobody really believes that a substantive negotiation is going to happen here. I think that from Mistura's perspective, and I'm not buying this, but just from his perspective, I think that what he believes is let's establish these contacts, these channels of communication, and a framework for dialogue, and then next time maybe we'll have some kind of dialogue. But all of this is BS anyway. The reality is what Mark and I were talking about, and Don, of course, what we were all talking about months ago, and even up to, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, where Mark and I had a bit of a disagreement about what the end game here is. Ultimately, all sides are trying to create the conditions on the battlefield in order to translate that into leverage in negotiations. That's the Russian, Syrian, and assorted Kurdish allies, along with, you know, the various other elements that are on that side of the conflict. On one side, the U.S. proxies, the terror groups, all of the rest of them on the other side. All of them are trying to do the same thing because, as I've argued for quite a long time, all of them understand that ultimately this is going to come down to a negotiated settlement. That Russia has said that many times from the very beginning. What they're trying to do, what the Russians are trying to do, is put the pieces in place on the battlefield and politically to be able to prevent the U.S. from dominating this process. That is really this sort of political jockeying that's going on here. And I think one of the major developments that illustrates that has to do with what we've heard about the Kurds and Kurdish-Russian relations and the increasing closeness of Russia and the YPG, right? That is, I think, a very significant element because aside from the two factions, the two major factions, the Kurds have been not
completely left. They've been completely left out of the negotiations.
They've been completely left out of the negotiations formally, but that's assuming that anybody believes these are negotiations. The Kurds were not allowed to be formally invited because of the United States, but obviously that's the United States doing that on behalf of Turkey.
And the Saudis too.
But from my perspective, though, the fact that the Kurds are going to be involved in this as quote unquote observers or whatever, or dialogue partners or something like that, that illustrates how much clout Russia now has in putting this whole thing together. Russia backed off from their original list of people that they wanted. They conceded certain people weren't going to be included. That was a concession I think they made strategically, but ultimately that's what this is about. And militarily, I just want to make one final point. I don't want to go on too long. Militarily, the question has to do with Kurdish offensive along the Turkish border, because the Kurds want to secure the entire Kurdish region of Syria and the Turkish border. That offensive, Turkey is already on record. I don't remember if it was Erdogan, Davutoglu, or which of them said on record that if the Kurds do that, Turkey will outright invade Syria. Now, they've done it already before with small incursions, but the language that they use said if the Kurds do that, Turkey invades. If Turkey invades and goes to slaughter the Kurds, what do you think Russia has to do at that point? This is a very dangerous moment for Turkey, and the U.S. are really pushing the envelope, and I think that translates into what's happening in Geneva and why the Kurds are there and why the Russians have as much influence as they do.
Yeah, that's the Kurds have been saying, the chatter is that there is an extremely large offensive meant to close off this Jarablus corridor coming from the Kurds in the next week or two. And if it does happen, you know, we've heard this before, we haven't seen it materialize, but if it does happen, it will be huge. All eyes will be on Erdogan to see what he does. It is obvious that they will not have U.S. support, because Biden went to Turkey last week and he was dissing all over the Kurds, right? Making clear that U.S. support is with the Erdogan regime in Turkey, which just opens up the Kurds even more for Russia. But I would expect not only them to be supplied by Russia, but to have close air Russian close air support if they do engage in this. It could potentially be game changing. So watch the Turkish Syrian border and see what the Kurds are doing over the next week. You can amuse yourself by what's happening in Geneva if you wish. But as Eric has said, none of this matters. Iran and Saudi are not ready for peace. Russia and Syria are not ready for peace. Baathists and terrorists are not ready for peace. And there will be a political solution at some point. But as the Washington Post pointed out last week, Russian airstrikes have been too effective. And because of that, the talks are in jeopardy. And what they mean by that is the position of the Syrian government and Russia right now is too strong. And whatever terms that the U.S. Saudi could and Turkey could get, respective of the current state of the battlefield, is not something they're willing to accept. So we won't see any serious peace efforts for another year, two, three, or four years down the line, when the other side has been thoroughly demolished on the battlefield. Most important for that is the closing off of the supply lines north of Aleppo, the Syrian-Turkish border, and we see the Syrian Arab Army doing the same in the south as they're seriously threatening U.S.-backed CIA proxy jihadist supply lines coming up from Jordan, where they have a military operations center, or MOM, that they hand out weapons and paychecks, just like they have a similar one in the north with Turkey. That is where we'll see serious peace negotiations pick off, only when the game has already been decided on the battlefield. And then there will be some semblance of a transitional government ascended. The Kurds will have a much larger role in any future in the future Syrian state. The Baathist party will continue to dominate Syrian politics, and we will see Syrian Sunni Salafist representation, but only the ones that have the intelligence to lay down their weapons at some point, because the rest of them will be fertilizer across the plains of Syria.
What about the prospect of essentially Russian air support for the Kurds facing off against NATO Turkish troops.
Yeah, crazy, huh?
Well, that's the danger. I mean, that's precisely the danger because, and quite frankly, I think that, well, I hope at least that people in Washington at least recognize to some degree the danger of that. And I know the Russians do. I mean, the Russians have repeatedly stated they want to take all precautions not to have some kind of an incident between the United States directly and Russia. Now, a couple of interesting things that I've noted in the last few days. If anybody saw, there was I think it was Washington Post, although I could be definitely wrong about that, but there was a report from some military experts, military analysts who said that contrary to U.S. bluster and propaganda, Russia is by no means at a, you know, at its critical threshold for what it's for its operations in Syria. In other words, that Russia has far more that it could be doing and that it could do this essentially in perpetuity. It could do it for as long as it needs to. I think they counted the number of sorties the Russians are running per day. They counted the amount of tonnage.
It shocks them.
Right.
So because the amount of sorties that they're conducting tonnage, effectively without accidents of the Russian military aircraft and logistically supporting it, and they're doing it at all at a cost of a really paltry $8 million a day, which they can continue for a long time, whatever the state of the Russian macro economy. The Pentagon is really, really impressed and scared by the Russian air campaign.
Well, there's two things I want to say about that, though. On the one hand, this illustrates a sort of a let's call it a schizophrenic or a cognitive dissonance in the political establishment, or let's call it the political military establishment in the United States, where the real military experts are saying what we were just describing, while Obama and his people and the neocons and all the rest of them are saying that, you know, basically that Russia's maxed out, that Russia's going to create a quagmire for themselves. And that's revealing because that's what the United States is trying to create for them, of course, but unsuccessfully, unlike 30 years ago or 35 years ago. But
the question is, do the politicians believe their own propaganda over the advice of their military experts?
I would not underestimate the power of self-deception. You know, okay. I think that buying into your own BS is oftentimes a quite powerful phenomenon. Now, the other thing that I want to mention, though, knowing Mark, I imagine he probably read this, but maybe not. The article in Foreign Affairs from, I think it's Alexander Motil.
It's
good. It's good. It's great reading. It's great.
Russia is falling apart for the 17th year.
Russia's fall. And there's a lot of internal contradictions in what he writes. It's comical reading, I think. But it is, I think, quite indicative of a mindset in Washington that's important to pay attention to, specifically because those types of people in the Beltway, I think, are oftentimes really believing what was written in Foreign Affairs. Russia's on the verge of collapse. Economically, it's about to collapse. Politically, Putin's regime is unstable. There could be a revolution, whatever the hell they're saying, you know. But contrast that with what the military people are saying about what Russia's doing. And I think you get a good indication of where the U.S. political establishment is at on this issue. In other words, they're nowhere.
You know, not only that, Stoltenberg gave his annual report this past week. And something very germane to this, there are two things really, but one was that he announced that they agreed to increase the presence of AWACS over Turkey, which would go to the thing we were discussing before about Russian air support for the Kurds or just the Russian role in general near the border. And the other was a reference to the eight small headquarters that they set up, basically ringing, you know, they made a forward movement of their their material, their men, all that stuff, the troops, that they said was the largest in decades. They've, you know, grown their military resources around Russia. Now, we've talked about them moving eastward, but even in terms of the aggregate amount of troops and materiel that are placed there, they are ready for a war, they think.
You mean Russia?
No. Russia NATO should be ready, but I'm talking about NATO. It looks like they've laid down the material basis to conduct a war.
Oh, yeah. There was a leak out of Sweden this week, military documents that reveal the Swedish top military officer saying that he fully expects Sweden to be at war with a capable opponent. It was clear he meant Russia within the next few years. Mm. And, you know, this is all part of, you know, the inevitability of Sweden and Finland joining NATO. They're already effectively a part of it, so it doesn't really matter to Russia on that score. I wanted to draw attention to something I think you guys probably heard this. Joe Biden, when he was in Turkey last week, came out all, you know, walking big, and he outright threatened that if that the U.S. is pursuing the political path with the Geneva talks, but if they don't, then the U.S. is capable and will seek a military solution. This is not in regards to ISIS. This is in regards to the Syrian conflict between the government and the U.S. and Saudi-backed, quote, rebels, unquote. Right. That is some serious smack talking there.
That's not the only one either.
That means war with Russia.
It's not the only one either. What's his name at the Pentagon was asked this past
Carter.
Week? Carter, about one of his top generals who had made a statement similar, that they were basically going to start a war in there.
Yeah. That is serious smack talking.
Yeah, I know, I understand the rhetoric, but those are two of the biggest loudmouth morons in the administration. I will say, remember, Biden also had that wonderful moment at Harvard University where he admitted openly that the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, and all the rest of them were arming al-Qaeda and had been doing it from the very beginning. Then he had to back away from that. Washington Post gave him cover, calling it a gaffe, mistake, whatever. You know, all Biden has a long history of making really
The gaffe machine, but I don't think this was a gaffe.
Oh, it's not a gaffe. No. I'm not suggesting that it's a gaffe at all. I'm saying it's a message. The question is whether or not there's anything actually backing that up, or whether that's Biden trying to talk big to the Turks and trying to maximize his ego for the last few months of his vice presidency. I don't know. Do I take it seriously? Maybe. I mean, I take much more seriously the issue of these. I guess what we could call, you know, parallel base developments in Turkey, which we were talking about last week, which I mentioned. I think that was last week. Yeah, that in Syria, that the U.S. you know, at the Ramil base, and that the Russians are potentially developing this base near Qamishli or Qamishli or however that's pronounced. And I think that is a much bigger indication of where we're at right now than anything that, you know, moron Biden or Ashton Carter have to say. And I think that there's two ways that can go. And I forgive me if I made this exact point last time, but one is that they will be used to run competing military campaigns, or two, that they will be used as bargaining chips in a negotiation for demobilization. I think both, and matter of fact, they're not mutually exclusive. Both of those things could happen.
Take a look. I want to take a look not only at the basis, of course, which is extremely important, but I mean, along with that, I mean, the U.S. is now illegally occupying Syrian territory with boots on the ground, right? And there's no indication, this whatever the rhetoric, that this is in any way, shape or form about ISIS. The U.S. has said that it is sending troops into Syria and Iraq. We all know they're mostly going to Syria. The U.S. already has almost 5,000 troops again in Iraq of various forms. But we're talking in Syria. They said they're sending in the 101st Airborne, which has been the vanguard of every U.S. invasion of intervention for the last 30 years. Right. They were originally saying 1,800 troops, but already less Then a week later, 6 days, we saw out of the Pentagon that they're already mission creep. They're not even waiting for the usual the period anymore, requesting another 800 troops. And we'll see this escalate and escalate further. God knows at this point how many American troops are already really on the ground in Syria. And I think this goes a little bit further than just a question of leverage. I think that this is the U.S. getting ready, and we've seen it with Turkey, the Turkish incursions into Syria, the Turkish bases popping up in the Kurdish parts of Iraq around Mosul that they still refuse to withdraw from. I think that they are seriously getting ready for the Brookings neocon plan
partition.
B. Yep. Yes, the partition, the complete, the creation
deconstruction.
Of Salaf, deconstruction of Syria, the construction of a Salafistan.
Yep,
in between
Agreed.
that will serve the purpose of at least if they can't destroy the Shia influenced arc crescent, they will at least split it. And I think that's where the U.S. is trying to maneuver towards at this point. I don't think that the administration. Certainly not the Pentagon and the intelligence wing, who are clearly at odds. Everyone's not on the same page at this point, but there's some scrambling in that direction.
Yeah. What about you have the, the Barzani Kurds in Iraq. You've got the group that is acting in Syria. Then they are not on the same page. And then you have, of course, the Kurds inside Turkey. What do you see happening in terms of gravity towards a Kurdistan?
Well, that's the question that we've been discussing here for a while now. And I don't know that we have an answer to that because, look, we've already mentioned that the Russians have made inroads with the Syrian Kurds. This we know, but I don't think that anybody should labor under the delusion that a couple of months of Russia really with a charm offensive in the Kurds is somehow going to roll back 30 years of U.S. and Israeli and other connections to various Kurdish factions, not only in Iraq but elsewhere. I think that what we are seeing is a sort of a battle for competition. Over influence with the Kurds, but to the extent to which they're factionalized, I think makes the potential of a truly united Kurdistan not likely, at least not in the near or medium term. I can't speak for decades from now, but
okay. Let's not say a united Kurdistan, but let's take a look at this seriously. A possibility between opposing Kurdish autonomous states
right.
within Syria and Iraq that actually fight each other.
A Kurdish autonomous state in Syria is almost by definition the open door for outright invasion by Turkey, I think. And so I think that going in that direction means we are now broadening the scope of this conflict, which is, of course, what Turkey at this point would welcome, I think. I think they would welcome any pretext to do that.
Ago. 3 years ago, Assad granted wide autonomy to the PKK and said, the YPG said, take it all you can, protect yourselves. We can't help you. That genie is already out of the bottle.
Well, indeed, in Syria,
that's guarantor of it. And the Barzanis rule Kurdish Iraq. And we've already seen, the clans in Iraq, the U.S. backed clans there, already. Aiding Turkey in attacking the PKK.
Well, this is what I'm saying is I was addressing the idea of a of united Kurds.
Yeah, opposing.
Right. Potentially, but I would also be, and I don't mean to be a wet blanket here, but I would also put a little bit of a spotlight on some of the things that the Syrian Kurds have done, and some of the things are not so nice, and some of those things include working with the United States when it suits them, working with Russia when it suits them, and I mean, that's how this game is played,
Kurds' interest is the Kurds,
so. Right? Exactly.
Turkish Kurds. What about if there were? Let's say you have a Syrian Kurd, a Syrian Kurdish region already autonomous, and they begin to set up maybe even a state. Turkey invades. What happens with the Kurds inside Turkey? And Barzani attacks.
Well, look, I mean, the problem is that the HDP, I believe that's the acronym for yes. Turkish pro-Kurdish party inside of Turkey. While they have influence and they have a base of support, they don't really have institutional power in any real way. They're not even one of the three main factions in Turkey as far as power goes. They're not the Erdogan Muslim Brotherhood camp. They're not the the CIA-backed Gulenist camp, and they're not the Kemalist Ataturk nationalist camp. So, you know, to the extent to which they have any real power is debatable. So if Turkey open – and when we say Turkey invading Syria, we don't simply mean Turkey invading Syria. We mean Turkey in all-out war against all Kurds, against all Kurdish factions, both inside of Turkey, the PKK, inside of Syria, all throughout the region, with the exception of Barzani's Kurds, most likely. And even that is questionable because of what they've done quite recently. So I think that we, on the one hand, obviously the Kurds make up a significant portion of Turkey's general population. I think it's about 20%, but I could be wrong exactly. But institutionally and politically, they have very little power. So the extent to which the Kurds would be able to do anything in the Turkish Kurds would be able to do anything, it would be dependent upon whatever developments happen with the Syrian Kurds. That is the linchpin for any action taken by Turkey's Kurds.
Okay.
Well, I mean, just in the last 2 months, we've seen, I mean, Turkey is one step away from a full-blown civil war with the Kurds right now. I mean, some of the Kurdish cities in the southeast there are essentially battle zones at this point. And I think you would both agree with me that the Turkish Kurds are much, much closer to the Syrian Kurds than, say, the Iraqi Kurds are. It would be a stretch to say that they are the same, but there's certainly a much greater degree of coordination and cross-pollination between the two of them.
Geography alone dictates that, and the politics of the last few decades dictate that as well.
I think it's inevitable. I think the fact that Turkey is going to be drawn into not only a civil war, but openly into the Syrian conflict against the Kurds, and that this will seriously further tax the insanity of the U.S. position in all of this. I think that a Turkish open involvement fighting the Kurds in Syria is inevitable, and it will spread up into Turkey. I'm not concerned about the Turkish representation or the Kurdish representation in Turkish politics. I'm more concerned about civil war in Turkey.
Yeah. Eric, I'm going to jump to your report because we're in the last 4 minutes, and maybe give Mark the last minute out of that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say very quickly, the United States has a special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa. That is the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burundi, Uganda, and Rwanda, and Tanzania. That region, very critical for rare earth minerals, very critical for diamonds and all kinds of other mineral extraction industries. The U.S. has been in various capacities fomenting war there since 1996, a Holocaust of epic proportions, more than 6 million dead. So the U.S. has a special envoy. Obama had originally appointed Russ Feingold. He was succeeded recently by Tom Perriello, who is now traveling in the region. Now, he went to Belgium and Italy. And after Belgium and Italy, his travels take him to Congo and to Burundi and to Tanzania. Now, there's just a couple of conflicts that I want to point out here. Number one is the internal conflict in Burundi. President Nkurunziza survived a coup attempt. He is deeply entrenching himself in power against what I would consider to be a U.S.-backed destabilization campaign against his government. So the U.S. is now on its way into Uganda to try to, into Burundi to try to foster a dialogue between the government and the opposition. This dialogue was supposed to happen in Uganda as it has previously. The United States demanded that that dialogue be moved to Tanzania. From my perspective, that is an illustration of a major gap that or gulf that has developed between Washington and the guy who used to be, I think, clearly their puppet, Yoweri Museveni in Uganda, who increasingly in the last few years has been unwilling to step down from power and has been unwilling to let the United States dictate to him that he's not supposed to have relations with China. That is a huge development in that region because a significant puppet and client state of the U.S. is in a sense moving out of its orbit, and they are being punished by the U.S. politically with regard to the Burundi question because Uganda is central to that entire conflict. And it's interesting to note, the United States demands democracy be respected in Congo, where President Kabila is refusing to step down, and in Burundi, where Nkurunziza doesn't want to step down. Interesting, and in Uganda as well, where the United States demands that Museveni step down. Interestingly, though, they're quite silent on Paul Kagame in Rwanda. Right. Why, I wonder, why is that? So we need to keep in mind this region because the coltan, the cobalt, all of those minerals that are essential for computer chips, cell phones, all of those things, it comes directly out of that region. The U.S. has a direct interest in maintaining the status quo and in preventing Chinese penetration. That's why Perriello's on this trip. That's what they're trying to do with the so-called democracy dialogue and all of the rest of that. Go ahead.
Bedmore.
Yeah, I'm not even going to venture there. Eric's knowledge of sub-Saharan Africa and the Third World in general buries my own. I certainly agree with everything he said. In my closing minute, what I'll draw us back to Syria and what I would like everyone to read for the week. I'd like to pick up with it during our next discussion. There was a really amazing piece that came out of the New York Times on the 23rd. By Mark Mazzetti and Matt Apuzzo. U.S. relies heavily on Saudi money to support Syrian rebels. There are some really amazing details about the Turkish, about the Saudi and CIA collusion in Syria, what they've been doing there, the funding of the of an arming of jihadis for the last few years. It's a little bit of disingenuous, because it downplays the U.S. role in all of it. And we know some of that's not true from earlier reports in the Washington Post. But there are some amazing details in this news piece as some really revealing things about U.S. foreign policy that it is so far in bed, not only politically but intelligence-wise with the Saudis. And I think everyone should really take a look at that piece and just open their mouths in a little bit of awe.
The title of it again is what?
U.S. relies heavily on Saudi money to support Syrian rebels. And pretty innocuous title, but there's a lot of crazy deep details about Operation Timber Sycamore, as it's been called there.
Which we've been reporting more or less without the name.
Yes, without the name for a long time. You know, the majority of our segments. Yes.
Okay, guys, thanks a lot. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Mark. Love
thanks,
you guys.
Eric.
Take care. Bye.
Next week.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.